This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Did fracking kill off peak oil, or just the world's hope of alternative energy? Coming up, energy guru Richard Heinberg on his new book, Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. But if conventional society can't power down, maybe we need a power shift. Two budding youth activists heading for the October Power Shift meetup in Pittsburgh tell it like it is. Later we'll hear Howard University senior Brian Menifee. But Radio EcoShock starts right now with this moving story from West Virginia. I'm Alex Smith. Maybe it's easier to be an activist with a degree blending into a big city. It's never been easy for Adam Hall. He is an example of why we do need a power shift in many ways. Adam, thank you for speaking out, and thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's great to be here.
So where are you from, Adam?
I'm from a little town called Glendaniel, West Virginia. It's in the southern extraction communities in the central Appalachian Mountains. I live kind of at a hub where most of the surface miners go to and fro from work. There's no active mining directly where I live, but it does have a way of helping keep the businesses, keep the momentum going for mining down in the lower portion of our state.
And talk to us about the nature you knew when you were young and then how you drifted into city life.
When I was young, my parents were still together, so it was really easy for me to just kind of be in the woods. And even after they separated, we still had, you know, an abundant forest right around anywhere I could go. But as I started getting older, my mom started needing to find more work in closer work locations. We were forced to move into a larger city urban area. So I was forced out of the woods into, you know, the concrete jungle, I guess, is the best way I can describe it. And it was roughly about 13 years before I was able to get back into the woods. And in that time, I forgot a lot about it. So I'm still catching up on a lot of my childhood, you know, I feel.
And then you did what many young people from Appalachia do. You joined the military. Is that right?
I did. When I was getting to the beginning of my junior year, I started realizing my academic career would be halted if I wasn't able to come up with the money. I didn't have a whole lot of access to like how to navigate through scholarships or any kind of work study programs or anything like that. So we did have recruiters who came in very frequently who mentioned that we could get the GI Bill for college education if we completed our service in the military. They don't seem to tell you all the hoops you have to jump through in order to get that money. I completed 4 out of a 6-year contract, and there was so much that after so many experiences across seas, I resisted a lot while I was in. They did chapter me out eventually, and it was a tough decision to make, knowing that that would be a mark on my record. I'm not very proud to have that mark, but it was either get myself chaptered out or, you know, never being able to come to grips with what was, excuse me for a second. When I talk about the military, I get so many different emotions, that come through. It's really hard.
It's not easy. And, you know, Adam, I think this is a powerful part of your story because I know at least a half dozen other vets who think their country could be better. Many served overseas. Now they're activists who are trying to fight peacefully and they still expect to win. Have you met other vets who are concerned about, for example, out of control climate change?
I've met one vet in particular, and she's been really, an inspiration to me. Her name's Maggie Martin. She works for Iraqi Vets Against the War. I always felt like she's a really powerful voice and she's really highly motivated. I like to keep up with what her work and everything. Her work kind of motivates me to continue doing the grassroots work here in southern West Virginia.
It sounds like your family has been wrapped up in Peabody Coal, and how could it be otherwise where you lived? Does that make it hard to criticize King Coal?
First of all, I really just want to stress that Peabody Coal is a demon on earth. My stepfather worked for Peabody almost 30 years, and he never worked for Patriot Coal one day. But when Peabody sold their union obligations to Patriot in this building, a company that was designed to fail, you know, it didn't just take my dad down, you know, it was on the verge of taking down, you know, whole communities in this area who worked very loyally for Peabody, and to have them turn their back on that kind of loyalty. I mean, there's nothing more than just absolute heartlessness there. This was all coming to a head when Patriot announced that they were filing for bankruptcy and that the union retirees' pensions and health care would be on the chopping block with that. At that same time, we were given this opportunity to go to St. Louis to help organize with Missourians Organizing for Reform and Empowerment, or MORE, and Black Mesa Indigenous Support in Flagstaff, Arizona. We all came together for an action camp last January, and I was given a good opportunity to go up on the steps of Peabody Coal's corporate headquarters, their global headquarters, and I addressed all of my grievances, all of my father's. And before I went, I asked every UMWA vet that I knew who worked for Peabody, who were involved with this, and I asked them what they felt and if it would be okay to try to help give them a voice. I knew that they couldn't get there, but could I in some way, like, yell whatever I could at Peabody to make them listen? And I got so many positive responses from that. And so for what little time I had a bullhorn in my hand, I wasn't yelling to that crowd for my own sake. It was for my father's and his friends and those people that he worked with and, you know, ultimately who were crushed, blown up, or, you know, are suffering from black lung disease right now. That was why I was there.
And it wasn't just the people who worked in the mines who got that pollution. It was the people who lived all around them. Coal is terribly polluting. Well, have you witnessed mountaintop removal mining, and what do you see?
I've been around quite a few active sites and a lot of sites that are going through what they call reclamation. I've seen how they've set up the explosives and when they detonate the explosives. It's really, really, you can't understand what it looks like to see a mountain, you know, hundreds of feet in elevation and littered with vegetation and water and wildlife, just like in less than a decade, you know, be shattered, be reduced to rock, and that is it. And I've seen what the aftermath of those mining practices do. I've lived in a community where we had the worst flood that many of the elders in that community has ever seen. And these people have lived in that community for 60, 70, 80 years. And none of them could remember a time that they've seen whole bridges blown out, houses floating downstream from 12 inches of rain that came down. I've seen water come out of faucets that just, I mean, water is a clear, you know, it's clear. I've seen water come out milky white and brown and black, you know, things that they expect people to drink here and be okay with it. And then there's so many more things, like the air that people breathe, the things that you can't see are even scarier than the things that you can see. That's what makes, I feel, this whole fight so much more difficult, is when we bring that issue up that the air here is actually absolutely toxic, you know. Nobody will believe us. And it's hard to show them or get any kind of regulators in this area, any kind of morally obligated regulators in this area, to do the proper necessary testing to prove to legislators and lawmakers that indeed our people are dying just from breathing air.
It's like smoking a pack of cigarettes a day or something, you know, just to live there, and it shouldn't be right. Not for the kids, not for everybody. Who was Larry Gibson?
Larry Gibson was, in my opinion, the greatest man who's really ever walked out of a hollow in West Virginia. The stories that he would always tell me about growing up, he really lived a life that was harder than I could ever imagine, from being kicked out of his home when he was just a kid to getting work with GM Motors and being fired from GM Motors for suspected organizing, from being, you know, from coming back home and then like having company men come to his house and offer him money for his land that he loved, that he grew up on, that he had these like childhood memories. And where I feel like that was what he wanted to do when he went back to Cape Verde Mountains. He was wanting to relive out some of his childhood that he was forced out of when he moved to Ohio. When Larry would not sell his land, when he would not budge off of his mountain, the companies who tried to do business with him, instead of leaving him in peace, they decided to blow up everything around him. Cape Verde Mountain, Stanley Ayres Park, is a 50-acre land trust that is surrounded on all sides by mountaintop removal activity. You can go to the top of Stanley Ayres Park, or you can go into the Stanley's family cemetery, and you can look everywhere around and see absolutely nothing. Cape Verde Mountain, where Stanley Ayres Park is, used to be one of the lower points of Cape Verde Mountain. Now it stands as the highest. Larry's air up there is extremely toxic. There is no water. The blasts from around the operation sunk all the water up there. And this was all, I feel like, in an attempt to make Larry surrender. And it did the absolute opposite. It really ticked him off. It fired him up to the point where he became a force to be reckoned with, in my opinion. And he traveled a lot of times money out of pocket, anywhere and everywhere where anybody would listen to him or lend him an ear. He would tell them the story of what was happening to his people in West Virginia, in Central Appalachia, in these extraction communities where they're blowing up mountains. He would go everywhere, wherever, to tell these people this. And it was 30 years. He worked for nearly 30 years on this issue. And it really... If it was not for him, we would not have an anti-mountaintop removal movement today.
And so that almost sounds to me like a kind of corporate terrorism with the government being part of it. You know, if you won't sell your land, we'll blow up everything around it. It doesn't get any worse than that. So how did Larry inspire you?
It was purely accidental, actually. I was just learning about the resistance to mountaintop removal in Appalachia. It was in 2009, and I met Larry I saw him around at events, but I never got to talk to him. But at this one point, I met him in a West Virginia caucus of residents who lived in West Virginia. I met him in this caucus at Georgetown University for this mobilization called Appalachia Rising. We talked about our experiences and what brought us to this mobilization, and I gave a very brief why I was here, what I was hoping to get out of it. I always tried to figure out what went through his mind, but I've never been able to. But all I know is that me and him ended up talking separately after that group meeting, up until about 6:30 the next morning, about just our lives, about why we love where we live. And he simply asked me, "I need help. Will you help me? Will you help us?" And I've never been a person to ever tell Larry no. Since then, I agreed I would love to help him. He had this idea for a program where he would recruit other speakers for his foundation to kind of cover more ground in the world, to give more people an opportunity to understand what mountaintop removal coal mining was. And I took off with him many times. I learned a lot from him just by sitting passenger side with him as he talked, and we drove 2 hours to 16 hours. And I would always, every time he opened his mouth, I would be more and more motivated to get this fight over with. I really wanted to win this fight. I wanted to end mountaintop removal before he passed away. But sadly, it did not happen. So even today, I have this utmost loyalty to his memory and his honor and what he did for me by inspiring me not only to stay here in West Virginia and fight, but to do everything I possibly can to bring as many people, as many voices to the fight that we possibly can.
Well, Adam Hall, many of us listening to you right now are burning electricity made from the coal that came from this mountaintop removal mining. So do you have a website or a Facebook page or any place you'd like to recommend we can tune in and find out what's going on?
One of the best ways you can find where your energy comes from, if you go to iHeartMountains.org, they have a link there where you can actually trace where your energy comes from. You can also check out Keepers of the Mountain Foundation online. We still have our speakers program. If you're anybody listening once would love to have one of our speakers out to give a more in-depth explanation on what mountaintop removal is and how the resistance is fighting in Central Appalachia, I encourage you to fill out a form to have one of our speakers come out and talk to you. I would also recommend the RAMPScampaign.org. The RAMPS Campaign is a nonviolent direct action group based in southern West Virginia, geared by community voices. They have done many amazing anti-mountaintop removal actions, including a tree sit that halted work on one permit for 31 days. They're very amazing people, and I would highly encourage anybody listening, if they would like to take a direct stand on mountaintop removal, to come and join them.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, listening with you to Adam Hall from Coal Country in Appalachia. He's not a lawyer, a scientist, or a writer. He's an American who cares about our climate and our world. Thank you so much, Adam. Adam Hall talked about iHeartMountains.org. He meant ILoveMountains.org. Find out more about Larry Gibson at www.mountainkeeper.org. RAMPS, Radical Action for Mountain People's Survival, is where you get your action on. That's RAMPScampaign.org. All those links are in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info.
But what does this mean? Let's look at the definition of modern agriculture. It's the use of land to convert petroleum into food. And we can see the end of the petroleum.
We've all been told hydraulic fracturing, fracking, will make the United States into the new Saudi Arabia. The UK, Poland, China, and probably everywhere else will get new energy riches too. Already, American oil and gas production have increased for the first time in decades. Has fracking proved the peak oil theorists wrong? Here to help us is one of the best-known writers on energy depletion. In 2003, Richard Heinberg published one of the first big books on the subject, The Party's Over, Oil, War, and the Fate of Industrial Societies. He's been publishing the popular newsletter since 1992. Now Richard Heinberg returns to Radio EcoShock with his answers to fracking. The new book is called Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. Richard, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, it's a pleasure to be speaking with you, Alex.
You say in your introduction to your new book that you need to speak to, quote, my people, the ones who have been warning about an energy shortage for years. Is the peak oil theory blown away by new technology in fracking?
Well, short answer, no, absolutely not. Basically, what we're seeing is peak oil in action. World production of regular conventional crude oil minus tar sands and tight oil has been declining since about 2005, 2006. Now, the shortfall has been more than made up for by tar sands and tight oil, and so world oil production has been increasing slightly in recent years, but at a cost, both financial cost. The oil industry is struggling. It's investing about twice as much in exploration and production as a decade ago, drilling twice as many wells to produce only marginally more product, and also an environmental cost, because all of the new production is coming from expensive and environmentally risky sources like the ones I've mentioned, tar sands, tight oil, also deep water oil. So as time goes on, more and more of the oil that's produced a higher and higher percentage will be from these marginal sources, and that's going to be both a financial problem for the industry to be able to maintain production, and the signs are that they won't be able to much longer, and also an increasing environmental risk for the rest of the world. So basically, this is exactly what the peak oil theorists have been talking about for for the last decade or more. And rather than talk about the death of peak oil, I think we should be talking about this is what peak oil looks like.
We should quickly define one term. What is tight oil?
Right. Tight oil is oil that's in reservoirs of rock that have very low porosity, or excuse me, permeability. So the oil or gas, the same principle applies to natural gas. The oil or gas is there, but it just doesn't want to move. So if you sink a conventional vertical oil or gas well into these kinds of rocks, you may get an initial little puff of production, but it won't last very long, and the amount of fuel produced won't be enough to pay for the cost of sinking the well. Geologists have known about these tight reservoirs for a long time, and we're talking here about the Bakken in North Dakota, which is a mostly oil-producing tight reservoir, and tight gas reservoirs like the Eagle Ford and Barnett in Texas, the Marcellus in Pennsylvania. These have been known about for a long time. Often they're called shale, like shale gas or shale oil. It's not always shale rock, but as a useful shorthand, that's just fine.
You talk about for a long time, and that sort of piqued my interest in something you wrote about in the book, that fracking has been around for a long time. It's not a brand new technology.
Yeah, that's correct. Hydrofracturing per se has been around for several decades, and it's widely used by the oil and gas industry, not just for producing from tight reservoirs, but also in conventional oil production, especially in secondary and tertiary recovery stages after wells start to decline. But what's different here is that when we talk about fracking today, we're mostly talking about the application of hydrofracturing in combination with sophisticated cocktails of chemicals. Up to 700 different chemicals are used, slickening agents, propants, and so on. And also together with horizontal drilling. Now, it's been necessary to combine these technologies in order to produce from these low permeability plays that we've been talking about, the tight oil and shale gas plays. And that's where the higher costs come from, and that's where the greater risks come from, because we're talking about wells that may cost up to $10 million a piece to drill, much more than a conventional oil or gas well, and wells that also entail much higher risks to air, water, and human health.
You do write about the environmental impacts of fracking, and we will get to that, but a lot of this book is about the economic illusion behind the fracking bandwagon. Beyond the energy companies, large and small, who are the players who are making big money from the fracking boom?
Well, you know, I would argue that the investment banks, Wall Street, has made as much money from the fracking boom as anybody else. All of the companies that are engaged in fracking, and mostly we're here talking about smaller companies, not the major oil companies like Shell and Chevron, BP, Exxon, but smaller companies like Chesapeake, Devon, Range, Anadarko, and so on. All of these companies are leveraged to the hilt. It costs them a lot to do business, and in many cases, they're not really making money from the sale of product. The way they're making money is through almost a kind of pyramid scheme where they're hyping the potential of shale production in the future as a way of increasing the value of their assets. And their assets, in many cases, consist of drilling leases. When this whole shale rush started just a few years ago, these small companies were competing with each other to lease as much land as possible. And very quickly, they leased millions of acres of land for drilling. Some folks in the audience may have seen the movie Promised Land by Matt Damon. It's kind of a fictional representation of what's been going on in the past few years in shale country. Well, it's by hyping future potential that the value of these leases is kept high, and companies are then able to borrow more on the basis of the value of their assets. They're also able to sell these shale drilling leases to other companies, including big companies like Shell and BP, and also foreign companies in China and other places. And that's how they've actually been subsisting. It's not so much on sale of product as on sales of assets, mergers, acquisitions, and so on. And Wall Street takes a big share in all of those kinds of financial transactions. So the companies are kind of, they're operating a kind of Ponzi scheme, if you will. And Wall Street is very happy to go along for the ride, and they make off like bandits one way or the other.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the name of the report. I think it came out of the UK. I covered it not too long ago about the possibility that the whole world economic system could crash because the big oil companies themselves were like a Ponzi scheme. They keep talking about their reserves and their possible future money in order to raise new stock money now. Can you remember what that was?
Well, there have been several articles because there's an effort now to talk institutional investors into divesting from oil companies because of the climate risk in producing all of these fossil fuels. And the argument is if we produced anything like the reserves that the oil and gas and coal industry claim, then, you know, we'd have climate Armageddon. So one way or another, all of those reserves of coal, oil, and natural gas are not going to be produced, which means that the value of the assets of these companies is not as great as they're claiming. And once again, even the big oil companies use the value of their assets as a basis on which to raise more money through stock shares or borrowing otherwise.
Do you think fracking is going to be a long-lived phenomenon or short-lived?
Well, you know, as long as the oil industry lasts, I'm sure fracking will be going on. What's not so sure is that we'll see anything like the current rate of production. Now, it's true, over the past few years, the U.S. has produced a lot of natural gas and oil through fracking. U.S. natural gas production is at its highest point ever. And more than all of the increase in the last few years has come from fracking because conventional natural gas production in the U.S. is actually falling. Similarly, with U.S. oil production, U.S. oil production had been in a decline since about 1970, and just in the last few years, U.S. oil production has actually picked up as a result of hydrofracking in North Dakota and Texas primarily. Now, the claim of the industry is that this is just the beginning, that we have 100 years of natural gas and the U.S. is about to become the next Saudi Arabia. The data do not back up those claims. We looked at the numbers at Post Carbon Institute. We purchased the rights to data on over 60,000 currently producing horizontally drilled and hydrofractured wells, both oil and gas in the U.S., and we looked at initial production rates, the rate of decline in production over time for each well, geographic location. What we found is that in each of the major plays where fracking is going on, there's a core area, usually just a few counties in extent, where production is pretty prolific and profitable. But if you get outside of those core areas, those sweet spots, initial production rates are much lower. Production rates decline very rapidly over time. So taking those decline rates into account, taking into account the high geographic variability and the quality of these plays, it appears to us that the claims that are being made for future production of tight oil and shale gas are wildly overblown. This is mostly hype. And before 2020, before the end of this decade, we'll be seeing declining U.S. oil and gas production, and perhaps rapid declines in both fuels.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with the longtime voice of Peak Oil and Energy Sanity, Richard Heinberg. We're talking about his new book on fracking, Snake Oil. Well, who is behind these never-ending press stories that America can have 200 years' worth of energy from fracking or be the new Saudi Arabia? It's fantastic stuff.
It is, and it's mostly these small companies that have led the charge. Chesapeake Energy, for example, for up until the last few months, its CEO was a guy named Aubrey McClendon, and he was famous for talking up the potential of shale gas. He testified before Congress. He wrote op-eds for the Wall Street Journal. You know, his voice was very prominent in all of this. And, you know, when he made these claims, they weren't really attached to any scientific studies. It was mostly just, you know, trust us, we're in the business. And so you find President Obama parroting basically the same line, saying that the U.S. has 100 years of natural gas, when there's no real data to back that up. This is really why I wrote the book. The title, Snake Oil, is not about the oil and gas per se that we're talking about. It's about the hype. It's about the inflated claims that have been made for shale gas and tight oil, and how those claims are undermining sound energy policy at all levels of government.
And you've talked about the work that Post Carbon Institute did before you wrote this. Tell us about the David Hughes report, Drill Baby Drill.
Sure. Yes, my book is largely based on this report. And David Hughes is a retired petroleum geologist who worked for the Canadian Geological Survey. And in that job, he prepared major reports for the Canadian government, crunching lots of numbers having to do with production of natural gas, coal, and other fossil fuels. So he's very well acquainted with the terrain. He has the analytic skills to be able to do a report like this. We really wanted to find out what was at the bottom of the shale boom. And as I mentioned earlier, we bought the rights to data on all of these wells. We bought them from a company in Austin, Texas, Drilling Info. And we produced what I think is, as far as I've been able to tell, the most comprehensive report or study that's been done to date on shale gas and tight oil, including by the International Energy Agency and the U.S. Department of Energy. And that 180-page report is available as a free PDF download. You can go to shalebubble.org. That's shalebubble.org. And download and read it for yourself. My book, Snake Oil, is basically an effort to put that information into layman's terms and then draw conclusions and also look at a few other aspects of fracking, like the environmental impacts and the Wall Street connection.
Could you, Richard Heinberg, please describe for us what Hughes calls the treadmill to hell, that constant need to drill more and more and more wells?
Right. Well, this comes from the high decline rates. All oil and gas wells decline in production over time. So if you drill a well in January, chances are by December of the same year, production of oil or gas will already have started to decline a little bit. Well, in the case of shale wells, particularly once you get outside of the sweet spots, the core areas, the decline rates are savage. We're talking about 60, 70, 80% decline in production in the very first year. So in order to even keep overall production steady on a straight line, it's necessary to drill and drill and drill. This is why we're talking about so many wells already having been drilled and lining up ready to be drilled. It's not as though the shale oil and gas industry can just drill a few wells and produce all of this product that they're talking about. They've already drilled tens of thousands of wells, and by the time all of this is over, they will have drilled many tens of thousands more with all of the attendant environmental risks and investment costs. Each of these wells, as I think I mentioned earlier, may cost $10 million to drill. We'll multiply that by 100,000. That's $1 trillion. And that gives you some sense of how much is being invested in this shale phenomenon.
Yeah, and you're right that each well has to burn about 2,000 gallons of diesel oil a day just to keep the rig running. What are some of the main environmental impacts? We won't be able to go into all of them, but maybe you could touch on what fracking does.
A lot of it has to do with water, both sourcing water, because it takes 3 or 4 million gallons to frack each well. So in places that have water shortages like Colorado and Wyoming, Texas and Oklahoma and so on, that's a problem, just getting the water, because the frackers are in competition with agriculture and city water use and so on. But also, there's the problem of what to do with the water once you've fracked. You have to take the water up out of the well in order to start producing oil or gas. Well, what do you do with it then? It has all these chemicals in it. It also has pollutants that have been picked up deep underground, very often radioactive elements. So do you put it in a holding pond and let it evaporate? Well, the holding ponds leak. Well, do you send it to a water treatment plant? Well, water treatment plants aren't prepared to deal with these kinds of pollutants. You can inject it back down deep underground into old oil or gas wells, and the industry likes to do that. But in that case, what you're doing is taking perfectly good fresh water, which is more and more at a premium these days, polluting it, and then taking it out of the hydrological cycle where it can never be used again. So there's no good answer to that problem. There are other environmental problems as well having to do with air quality and human health, health of pets and livestock and wildlife that have all been traced, documented to fracking.
And we do have to now consider deep ground ecology. There is life down there, maybe bacterial life, plus important networks of water. Will those million-old wells, if we get that many, will they leak? Will they create unwanted pathways for underground change?
There is a study that was published in a peer-reviewed industry journal suggesting, just a couple of years ago, suggesting that evidence is coming down on the side that says that eventually just about all oil and gas wells will leak. I mean, during the period in which the oil or gas well is actually being used, it's producing, if it's properly drilled, properly cased and cemented, chances are there won't be any contact between the well bore and the water table. But that's a pretty brief stretch of time. We're talking about maybe 10 years, something like that, maybe 20 years. What happens after that? Well, of course, the well is plugged and abandoned. But the well casing may fail decades, centuries afterward, and at that point there's every possibility for water table to be contaminated by the oil or gas or by other chemicals.
You know, I was just thinking about this. Richard Heinberg, a lot of your life, your research, your books are about the underground world from oil to coal. I wonder, why did you spend so much time looking downward?
Right. Well, I never really thought about it that way, you know. My interest in fossil fuels has nothing to do with some inherent fascination with geology. I didn't even study geology in school. My interest is in energy and social, environmental, historic, political implications of energy. And fossil fuels have been the biggest energy story of the millennium. I mean, there's been nothing before them that were anything like fossil fuels, and we probably will never have anything like them again. They're changing the climate. They have completely altered the economy of the world. And most people just take them for granted. So, you know, to me, this is not something to be taken for granted. We're living in an extraordinary moment in human history. And if we don't understand the role of fossil fuels in this moment, then we're just not getting it.
We can't leave fracking without talking about the myth that could drive us all into an overheated extinction, and that is that fracked natural gas is a bridge fuel and a cleaner alternative to coal. Is that true?
I don't believe so. There's a lot of controversy on this. There have been studies that say that methane being a more powerful greenhouse gas than CO2, that methane leaking from fracked natural gas wells is coming out in such quantities that it does away with any possible climate advantage to switching over to generating electricity from natural gas as opposed to coal. Then there are other studies coming out, mostly funded by the natural gas industry, that say, no, the leakage is very small and there is a tremendous climate advantage to burning natural gas. The scientists are going to be trying to sort this out for some time. It appears to me that the industry-funded studies are being very carefully constructed to look only at natural gas wells that are properly drilled and cased and cemented, where nothing is going wrong. And some of the other measurements that show very high leakage are probably taking into account wells where, you know, everything wasn't done exactly according to standard. And so we may find at the end of the day that, in fact, the folks who are raising the alarm about natural gas leakage are in fact onto something. But in any case, the promise of natural gas as a bridge fuel rests entirely on the assumption that we have enough of the stuff to be able to burn it instead of coal for decades to come while we gradually, slowly build a renewable energy economy, maybe by mid-century or so. Well, you know, we don't, in fact, have that much natural gas. If our study at Post Carbon Institute is correct, you know, before the end of this decade, we'll be seeing declining production of natural gas. That's not a bridge fuel. It's a bridge to nowhere. It's a gangplank.
And as we might expect from a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute, you do write about an alternative energy reality. You call it hydrocarbon rehab. Do you want to give us a sneak peek, a quick snapshot? What are you talking about there?
In our future, we will have less in the way of fossil fuels, no matter what we do. We will have a renewable energy future by the end of this century, one way or another, whether we've planned for it and worked for it, or whether it's just a matter of using all the fossil fuels we can afford to get out of the ground and then letting the economy collapse in a dead heap. A better way to go would, of course, obviously be to build that renewable energy economy proactively, starting now, starting 10 years ago, starting 20 years ago, if we could. Obviously, we can't, but we can at least start now. And it's really the only way we can ensure a sound economic future. Otherwise, we're handcuffing ourselves to an energy economy that has no future.
Can you please just give us a couple of websites where people can follow your work?
Absolutely. A good one is resilience.org. That's our institutional website for Post Carbon Institute. And also, if folks are interested in the book Snake Oil, they can find out more about that also on my website, which is richardheinberg.com.
Richard's the longtime author of the online journal The Muse Letter. He's been the voice of the peak oil movement with books like The Party's Over and Peak Everything. We've been talking about his latest of 10 books, Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. It's a good read, packed with facts we all ought to know. Richard, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
It's a pleasure, Alex. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We wrap up this Radio EcoShock show with another voice the mainstream media misses. Another eco-activist youth headed for this year's power shift in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, October 18th to 21st. Get the details at wearepowershift.org.
We all know the game from childhood. Rock beat scissor, scissor beat paper, paper beat rock beat scissor, etc., etc. What you don't understand is that the 1% of this planet uses the paper game to control all things generation, generation, generation. I invite you global people to come together like rock, five finger, form fist, and destroy this absolute tyranny. Don't drill into Mother Earth. Don't create this chaos. Rock, go strike Goliath dead. Pull back the sling.
Rock Beats Paper featuring Kevin Mambo, released September 25th on BlackSwanSounds.com. We find Brian Menifee, already a leader in Washington, D.C., as a Howard University senior. Brian, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
When you talk about the environment, you always seem to talk about justice, too. Why is that?
Well, I think about when you want to talk about the environment, you have to talk about justice, because when you talk about different things that are, I guess you could say, going wrong with the environment, it's an issue about justice. You know, when you talk about oil refinement or getting raw materials from the earth, most of the places that they do it in are in places where the people do not have the political power to stop these things from happening. When you look at the tar sands on the indigenous peoples reservation, when you talk about communities located in the Gulf Coast region where the pipeline is actually supposed to end at, a lot of these communities where it's happening in don't have the political power to prevent these kind of environmental disasters from happening. So yeah, that's why I think when you're thinking about the environment, you always have to think about justice, because when you think about justice, then you can start kind of connecting the dots with other issues that aren't really kind of talked about, you know, such as police brutality, you know, income, the disparity of income and the wealth gap, because I think all those things are connected when you're talking about the degradation of our environment.
Well, I think there's two big parts to that, and one you've raised, which is we want people to have a vote about climate change, but a lot of African Americans don't have the vote, and we know white people commit the majority of crimes, yet people of color are more than half of the prison population. When they come out, they can't vote, so that disenfranchises people from their own country, I feel. What's your feeling on it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And of course, with that, I mean, you can clearly see that implementation of, you know, if you have a felony, then you cannot vote, just another way and tactic to get people who don't have anything to have even less, you know what I'm saying, to make sense of people, to see them as criminals and as people that should not be able to participate in society. And then, like you said, I mean, it disproportionately affects Black people and people of color. And I mean, I definitely think that that's just, you know, another way, because I mean, we can all see that the prison system is a way for people to make money off of us. Yeah. I mean, it's a tragedy.
It is a tragedy. And you raised the other point I was thinking of, which is we had a guest on Radio EcoShock who explained the reality in Harlem. And she said, if you need a place to put a dirty truck terminal or a waste disposal company or even a coal-fired power plant, you just dump it in the African-American community. And have you seen that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. There in Washington, D.C., there's a community in the northeast part of Washington, D.C. It's a predominantly Black community called River Terrace. And basically, they're going to put a bus depot in this River Terrace community. It was going to be like some mega buses, you know, buses that like basically go up and down the East Coast. There's going to be a bus depot there. So it's going to be 24-hour buses going in and out. Not to mention the kind of, you know, the CO2 emissions from the buses, but the noise aspect of having a bus depot in the community. But the community fought back and the bus depot didn't end up being built in that community. But yeah, I mean, it happens all of the time. I mean, if you want a bus depot, if you want to, you know, find somewhere to put an incinerator, it's usually going to be put in the people of color community or somewhere out in the outskirts. You know what I'm saying? So yeah.
Well, you know, most of the developed countries are getting so that 1% of the very rich people and 99% just get poorer by the day. That was the theme of the Occupy movement. What did you think of that, Occupy?
I guess we all have, I guess, some kind of ups and downs about the Occupy movement. I think the Occupy movement sparked a lot of people to see that there's another way to do things. And I think a lot of people were affected not only by just like seeing how people were coming together and standing up, but also like, you know, when people visited these kind of autonomous communities all throughout the United States, they saw how people were having meetings, how people were like holding different things, like showing that there's another way to live than the way that we're kind of like portrayed or that we're taught to in school. I mean, I think the Occupy movement, there was some good things about it. I think for the most part, it was a lot of people that, I guess, a lot of privileged people that weren't used to, I guess, things that people of color and people without privilege are used to. So, you know, in this time, you know, since the disparity of wealth, now people are saying, oh, there's no more jobs, or, oh, I can't get hired at this place, or, oh, I went to college and spent all this money on the education, but I still can't get a job. And it's like, well, now you're in our shoes. This is like how it's been for us for decades, you know, since we've come to this country. So I think for a lot of people, it's a realization to like what a lot of people in this country and around the world feel on a day-to-day basis. But I think it was a movement, and I think we got to like move forward.
All right. Now let's talk about Power Shift. Do you see that as a movement? And if so, what is Power Shift doing?
I think Power Shift can be a movement. I think what its goals are, what its aims, especially this Power Shift, trying to reach out to frontline communities, people of color. They're trying to reach out to historically Black colleges and universities to kind of come and contribute. I think that's a step forward in a process to bring a lot of different people from a lot of different backgrounds together in one place and kind of just talk about the things that we're facing and how we can come together to kind of change the system that we're in. So I definitely think that Power Shift and more things like Power Shift need to happen to bring a lot of people from a lot of different backgrounds come together to talk about things, but also network and exchange information so that we can build this kind of network of people that are trying to change the system that we live in today.
Well, we just heard on Radio EcoShock from a person who thought Washington was just getting too hot for too long to live outside of anything that's air-conditioned. Do the students realize climate change is happening, and what's going on at Howard University?
I think for a lot of students, I mean, climate change is definitely real. Maybe not to the point of being able to articulate it, but I think of a lot of people understand, especially people at Howard University that have come from the Gulf Coast who were there for Katrina, who were there for a lot of the hurricanes that have hit the Gulf Coast over the last few years. You know, communities who are coming from the South in general, from Florida, you know, because I know they get hit with hurricanes pretty often. I think they understand the reality of, like, what happens when Mother Earth is not is not doing well. And then I think coming together at Howard University and having that kind of experience, being exposed to a lot of different things and a lot of teachers and a lot of books that you're not really given a chance to read in, like, a public educational system, or, in my opinion, any kind of, like, other educational system that doesn't put forward a lot of different kind of, like, writers and artists other than kind of, like, white males. You know what I'm saying? So I think when you get people together like that, I think people are more aware and more conscious about what's happening to the environment. And it's definitely on people's minds about how, you know, they can see how the climate is changing, not only in Washington, D.C., but they're kind of seeing, like, different things happen, these floods and these fires happening. And I think with, like, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and, like, kind of all of these social media that, like, kind of, like, when anything happens, it's like, basically right there on their fingertips. So I really do think that people, especially at Howard University, are more aware to what's going on, and it's starting to, like, kind of, like, oh, yeah, you know, these things are connected, you know what I'm saying? Just my opinion from being around in the student body, it's definitely a connection being made about we need to be more aware about the climate, and we need to do something about it, and not just, you know, kind of like, oh, you know, maybe the next generation will do something.
Yeah, well, you talk about storms. A lot of people don't realize D.C. almost got nailed by Hurricane Sandy. It just happened to go a little further up the coast before it turned inland. And what happened in New England could have flooded Washington, the Potomac, Chesapeake Bay. It's just a matter of time before these violent storms hit. But it's so hard to tell people that.
Yeah, it definitely is. And it's another thing, too, is that all across the United States, the infrastructure system is horrible. Like, when you talk about the levees in New Orleans, or when you talk about, you know, even in Washington, D.C., Washington, D.C. still basically, like, the sewer system and the drains on the street drain right into the Chesapeake Bay. Like, anytime there's a big, like, flash flood or anything like that, the wastewater treatment facilities can't hold the water that's coming into it. So they basically just, like, let everything flow into the river. I mean, and you can understand of, like, how raw sewage can affect the ecosystem just on that, like, kind of micro scale level. So, yeah, like, if a storm like Sandy could come through, I mean, it could really damage not only the infrastructure, but the ecosystem in general.
Well, you know, I was talking with someone about this whole thing of the heating up and the drying out of the South, and he was of the opinion, he was an African-American cook, as a matter of fact, that we had on the program, he was of the opinion that really African-Americans were going to be able to adapt better than all the white people were. What's your thoughts on that?
I could understand that for a degree, because I think as African-Americans, we've been able to kind of deal with kind of, like, harsh realities. I'm not saying that everybody, all African-Americans have the same experience, because that's not true. But I definitely think that people who grow up without as much privilege are able to cope and deal with kind of a changing environment more than people who have, like, kind of gone up with privilege and gone up with a sense of entitlement that, you know, think things are going to be this certain way. And when they don't end up being that certain way, they kind of just, like, freak out and, like, oh, I don't know what to do. You know, just kind of, like, taking their hands off the steering wheel and just letting whatever happens, instead of, like, taking control of the situation, figuring out, okay, you know, this is going to happen. We need to do this. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So, I do think I know where he's coming from when he says that.
Well, all right. So why are you going to this Power Shift meetup in Pittsburgh?
Well, personally, I want to go to this Power Shift because I think it'll be a good way to network with people with like-minded people who have basically the same goal. you know, the same goal to try to change the system that we're in right now, the same goal to kind of like change the surroundings that we are, because we feel like that there is a different way of living, there's a different way of interacting with people than what we're on, what we're doing right now. So for me, it's, you know, it's connecting, you know, Black students, it's connecting basically everybody that's coming to PowerShift together and creating a network, a solid network of people that are trying to uplift and change things. Because I think although we need to uplift and put forth the frontline communities and, you know, let that struggle be known, it's going to take everybody coming together to kind of like facilitate a new change of this system.
And have you got some plans on or thoughts what you're going to do after you graduate?
Actually, I have no idea. I'm studying mechanical engineering, and so I'll be graduating in December, but I actually have no ideas. I've been doing kind of like research and like have more aligned my studies with like energy and kind of water purification, specifically water access in Palestine. But yeah, I'm not really sure where I'm not going to go.
Well, water access in Palestine, you know something. Take it from me, Brian. Once you become a troublemaker at a young age, it never leaves you. You just can't accept that bad things are going on. You're always looking for justice. Are you really ready for that?
I think so.
It's been great talking with you. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We've been talking with Brian Menifee from Washington, D.C. Join us next week for more Radio EcoShock in our first broadcast from the mountains. All our music this week is from the new album Rock Beats Paper by Earthrise Sound System from Black Swan Sounds. Get the links you need from my show blog at ecoshock.info. If you know a station that should be carrying Radio EcoShock, please write me. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. Download all our past programs as free MP3s at our website, ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for your support, and a special thanks for caring about your world.
Yeah, Earthrise Sound System, Street Color, Duke Mushroom on the Hook, SCC. Let's stretch it out like Dawn or Mitra. No beef can come between us because our love has a special feature. New paradigm and you know I'm so excited. A planetary party and you know you're all invited. Feels so good you decided not to fight it. Now let it in like the sun shining.
Let's stop drawing. Let's take it further. It sounds like we all want the same thing.
friends, little family, that's the main thing. And if you need a reminder, we're looking forward, never not behind ya. Yeah. From New York, Africa to China, bringing the light that'll never blind ya. Waiting for, hey.